Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Monday, June 19, 2023. A former Sudanese official says residents of Khartoum had a peaceful night over the weekend.
So far, we've seen a full commitment on that agreement. We haven't seen any air strike moving on the Khartoum sky. We haven't heard about fire gun from the many parts of the capital.
And an official with the UN's Children Agency says 13 million children in Sudan need urgent help.
Without immediate funding commitments, the ongoing response across Sudan, including in the Darfur's, will not be able to continue and scale up to meet the urgent life-saving needs.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Sudan's ceasefire appears to be holding, according to one observer in Khartoum. The three-day ceasefire agreement was brokered again by the United States and Saudi Arabia to allow unhindered delivery of humanitarian assistance throughout Sudan. It comes as a humanitarian donor conference is scheduled to start today in France. Mohamed Al-Taashi is a former member of the Sudan Sovereign Council. He tells VOA's James Batty that Khartoum was quiet on Sunday. However, he says Sudan needs a longer ceasefire.
So far, we've seen a full commitment on that agreement. We haven't seen any air strike moving on the Khartoum sky. We haven't heard about fire gun from the many parts of the capital. We haven't seen any official allegations or complaint from any of these two parties. And we haven't seen any sort of military movement. So I can describe Khartoum today as quiet as ever before, at least for these last 2 months. And every single person in this capital can see the difference between the conflict and the introduction of the peace. I think Sudanese people deserve a comprehensive peace.
There is a Sudan humanitarian donor conference taking place on Monday, June 19. Do you think because of this donor conference that this ceasefire, which is especially for humanitarian purposes, can hold?
That, I think, in my opinion, is a positive movement from the international organization and international community. As we do know, there is 25 million Sudanese people desperate for aid, and they are running out of food and basics. So the international comes in the time, in its time. And I think there would be two problems, as you know. One, we don't see an official Sudan administration. And that would be one of the problems. I think there is a lack of trust from the international toward this ongoing administration. And also there is a lack of, a deficit of trust from the Sudanese people as well. So I think the organization need to see the way they can operate the aid directly to the residents. That's number one. Number two, I think a short-term ceasefire agreement isn't enough to allow the organization can reach out the desperate people or living there in the cities and outside the cities. So the international conference require, in my opinion, at least a 1 month or 2 month ceasefire agreement. Because without the ceasefire agreement, would be no way for the organization to find the corridors to go directly for the desperate people.
That's Mohamed Al-Taashi, a former member of the Sudan Sovereign Council. He spoke with Daybreak Africa host James Batty from Khartoum earlier today. Still in Sudan, UNICEF says the ongoing fighting has left more than 13 million children in dire need of humanitarian assistance. UNICEF spokesperson for Middle East and North Africa says hundreds of children have been killed and injured during the ongoing fighting in some parts of Sudan. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Juba.
In a report released on Thursday, UNICEF says the condition of children in Sudan is horrible due to the ongoing conflict. Speaking to VOA from Amman, Jordan, Amar Amar, UNICEF's regional chief of communication and advocacy for the Middle East and North Africa, says more than 330 children were killed and 1,900 others injured during the first week of June.
The children are trapped in a violent crisis they had no part in creating, bearing the heaviest burden of the conflict. They are caught in the crossfire, facing injuries, abuse, displacements, and the risk of disease and malnutrition.
Amar says access to basic services is limited across parts of Sudan, including Western Sudan's Darfur region, where hundreds of thousands of children and their families have been displaced by the ongoing conflict between Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces.
The lack of safe water poses a significant risk to hundreds of thousands of children, making them vulnerable to dehydration, diarrhea, and malnutrition. Right now, at least 14,836 children under five are expected to be severely malnutritioned in West Darfur State. These numbers are expected to be compounded by overall health risks, forcing a spike in malnutrition rates among children and lactating mothers.
He adds that the situation in West and Central Darfur is characterized by active fighting, severe insecurity, the looting of humanitarian supplies and facilities. Amar is calling on aid agencies to provide life-saving humanitarian support and protection to vulnerable children. He says UNICEF needs additional $253 million to address the current humanitarian crisis that began on April 15th.
Without immediate funding commitments, the ongoing response across Sudan, including in the Darfur, will not be able to continue and scale up to meet the urgent life-saving needs. Overall, UNICEF Sudan appeals for cooperation, commitment, and action from all stakeholders involved in order to protect the rights and well-being of children of the children affected by the conflict in Sudan.
The UN Children's Agency is calling on all parties involved in the ongoing fighting across some parts of Sudan to protect children and grant free access to aid agencies operating in areas affected by the ongoing conflict in Sudan. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Uganda, where police say they have arrested 20 suspected collaborators of the Rebel Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, who allegedly killed 42 people in a school on Friday night. For VOA News, Alima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Addressing journalists at the Naguru Police Headquarters in Kampala, police spokesperson Fred Enanga revealed security personnel had arrested 20 suspected collaborators of the Allied Democratic Forces rebels, the ADF militants with ties to the Islamic State group. This comes as Uganda's armed forces continue to pursue the rebels in the areas of the Rwenzururu Mountains and into the Democratic Republic of Congo's Virunga National Park.
We also have the head teacher and the director of school. As part of our inquiries, they need to give us answers to certain questions.
The suspected ADF rebels attacked the Lubiriha Secondary School in Mpondwe, Kasese District Friday night, killing 42 people, including 37 students. According to the police, the attackers set fire to the boys' dormitory and attacked the girls with machetes. The burned bodies of 17 male students were recovered. Six people survived with injuries and are being treated in different hospitals in the country. Even though 25 bodies have so far been examined and identified, only 23 have been handed over to families for burial. The student victims ranged in age from 12 to 25. The Allied Democratic Forces rebels have previously carried out attacks in Uganda. This was the first ADF attack on a school in 25 years. In June 1998, the ADF attacked Kichwamba National Technical Institute in the Kabarole district, killing 58 students. At the time, students had locked themselves in a dormitory to avoid being abducted, and the rebels retaliated by setting the dormitory on fire. Nearly 100 students were abducted. The Allied Democratic Forces, whose founder, Jamil Mukulu, has been imprisoned since 2015, operate in the Rwenzururu Mountains in Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. The group has been fighting the Ugandan government since 1996. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk-Tans, warns human rights around the world are in difficult state as countries are failing to honor the fundamental rights and freedoms of all peoples as enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Turk spoke today at the opening of the UN Human Rights Council's upcoming four-week session. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Human Rights Chief Volker Turk said human rights are the cornerstone of the United Nations, but he added these rights are at a critical juncture because of the self-serving interests of too many governments that are taking precedence over international cooperation to advance human rights. In a sweeping global review of the human rights situation in dozens of countries, the High Commissioner highlighted the many atrocities and crimes being committed in all regions of the world, including Africa. He pointed to egregious cases of abuse and discrimination in countries such as Uganda, which recently adopted legislation criminalizing homosexuality. He criticized Mali's request for the withdrawal of MINUSMA, the UN's peacekeeping mission, saying human rights must always be above the fray of politics. He deplored worsening conditions in South Sudan.
Regrettably, reported violent incidents affecting civilians rose by 12% in the first 3 months of this year, and there has been little action by the authorities to hold perpetrators to account. While senior government officials allegedly implicated in serious crimes remain in office.
Turk lambasted Eritrea for its ongoing refusal to engage with the full spectrum of human rights bodies. Though Eritrea was a current member of the Human Rights Council, he said the government has never allowed the Special Rapporteur on Eritrea or any other independent human rights expert to investigate the prevailing human rights situation in the country. He noted Burundi also is not granted access to or cooperated with the Council's Commission of Inquiry or other investigative bodies since 2016. On the other hand, he said Ethiopia has cooperated with the office, enabling him to send international human rights monitors to the north.
I also note the potential for cooperation on development of a transitional, on a comprehensive transitional justice policy. However, Ethiopia does not engage with the International Commission of Human Rights Experts established by the Council, and I continue to encourage such engagement ahead of its report.
The Commission report on Ethiopia is due to be presented to the Council in September. On a more positive note, High Commissioner Turk said his office's support of Mauritania's efforts to end discrimination, notably the persistent issue of slavery, is bearing fruit. He said at least 38 cases of slavery have been brought to court, with 10 judgments made in the first 2 months of this year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the UN mission in South Sudan say hundreds of civilians face all kinds of abuses in the country. Find out why after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A new report by the UN mission in South Sudan says violence against civilians persists across the country. The report says the mission documented 920 incidents of violence against civilians during the first quarter of the year. The report argues that intercommunal violence by militias are the primary drivers of violence affecting civilians in the country. For VOA News, Deng Gai Deng reports from Bor.
Ben Dotsay Malor is the Chief of Strategic Communication and Public Information at the United Nations Mission in South Sudan. Malor says compared to the same reporting period last year, the findings show a 12% increase in violent incidents against civilians.
According to the latest quarterly human rights brief from the United Nations Mission in South Sudan, UNMISS, from January to March this year, the mission documented 920 incidents of violence against civilians, during which 405 civilians were killed, 235 injured, 266 abducted, and 14 were subjected to conflict-related sexual violence.
Malor says 22 cases of extrajudicial executions were documented between January and May 2023, in which 14 persons, including one female, were executed in Warabe State and 8 in Legi State. He adds that the executions were allegedly committed by South Sudan security personnel.
Intercommunal violence by community-based militias and or civil defense groups constituted the primary source of violence affecting civilians and accounted for more than 92% of all civilian victims. Much of the violence was generated and documented in Jonglei State and the Greater Pibo Administrative Area in the conflict which erupted in the beginning of the year. This was followed by Warabe State, Central Equatoria, Eastern Equatoria, and Lakes States.
Major General Lul Rai Kong, a spokesperson of the South Sudan People's Defense Force, denies his forces carried out extrajudicial executions as alleged by the UNMISS.
We have security personnel that are operating under the leadership of the national government. We have the one operating assigned to the state government as well as county governments. So I do not have a clear picture of what they are saying. But for you to get accurate information, you get in touch with the state governments of Warabe and Lagos State. Because if they were committed, then maybe they were committed by security operators assigned to them at that level of government.
William Wall is the information minister in Warabe State. Wall says the UNMISS report is not accurate.
So Warabe State is abide by the laws, by the constitutions, and no any other means or any other shortcut for actually executing any human being or breaking the human rights. There is no any kind of, you know, extrajudicial killing in Warabe State so far. So that report is actually politically motivated, and we condemn it in strongest terms possible as government of Warabe.
Some communities in Twitch County of Warabe State have been experiencing intercommunal violence since last year. The acting information minister for Lagos States, William Koji, disputes the UN report.
They have to be arrested and brought to book, brought to the court, you know. Yeah, the other time, they were not been managed to be arrested by the security forces. But the difference this time is that the security has power of arresting anyone that has gone wrong. So it has nothing to do with the extrajudicial killing.
The UN mission helped the South Sudan government to release the findings of several investigations commissioned by the President Salva Kiir's office to the public so that criminals are held accountable. For VOA News, I am Deng Gai Deng in Bor.
From Bor, we go to Rumbek, where lawmakers at the Lake State Legislative Assembly have suspended the chairperson of a committee allegedly soliciting money from owners of pharmacies and clinics in Rumbek town. Simon Mawor Majak, who headed the committee, denied collecting money from anyone. For VOA News, William Sande Mabor reports from Rumbek.
2 weeks ago, a parliamentary health committee charged with investigating missing medicine from the government stores reported that some private pharmacies and clinics have medicine intended for free distribution on their shelves. This week, the leadership of the State Legislative Assembly suspended the chairperson of the health committee, Samuel Mawor Majak, for alleged corrupt practices during an assessment exercise. But Majak denies collecting money from the private clinics and pharmacies in Rumbek Town. He says he conducted an assessment of the clinics and pharmacies in response to the reports that medicine distributed to hospitals are sold at private pharmacies in Rumbek.
This suspension is not according to the law because it's based on the interest. First and foremost, I went to the market for assessment of all the clinics and pharmacies, and it is mandated by law.
Zakaria Pori Matuang is the chairperson of the Lagos State Legislative Assembly's Specialized Committee for Information and Communication. He accused Majak of collecting more than 100,000 South Sudanese pounds from the private pharmacies and clinics. The lawmaker says Majak has been asked by the leadership of Lagos State Assembly to apologize for his actions and the alleged involvement in soliciting money. Matuang says the state parliament also ordered Majak to compensate some of the owners of pharmacies and clinics in Rumbek Town whom he paid bribes during the inspection.
Our leadership has resolved that the administration of the assembly should refund back that the embezzled amount, which is 111,500. But later on, insist and to disobey the advice of the leadership, we resolve it that money he has to pay them back by his own way. Whether it was paid by administration, he has to refund back that money to the assembly. Because he's breaching our constitution and our conduct of business.
Zakaria Makir, a lawmaker representing the SPLM-IO in the State Legislative Assembly, who was a member of the health committee, says his team did not collect money from private health facilities during an inspection exercise.
I was with them in that supervision. We were inspecting the clinic, the pharmacies, the drug stores, and the other health places where human drugs are being administered or are being sold. So the wholesale pharmacies, all those we inspected with them. I did not witness something like that, but to our surprise, the leadership or those who might be having something with them, they say that the share has been collecting some money with the coal revenues. That one, I did not witness anything like that.
South Sudan in Focus reached out to some owners of the pharmacies and clinics in Rumbek Town for comments, but they declined. For VOA News, I am William Sande Mabur, reporting in Rumbek, Lagos State.
Today, Monday, marks the Juneteenth federal holidays in the United States. The name comes after the day the end of the U.S. Civil War in 1865, June 19, when U.S. soldiers arrived in the island city of Galveston, Texas, and informed slaves that they were free. Slaves had already been freed in other parts of the South, but most slaves in Texas were kept in bondage until the army arrived. As Craig Flukas reports, while the holiday is now celebrated nationwide, it has special significance to the people of Galveston.
The celebration of Juneteenth in Galveston, Texas, began several days before the actual holiday with picnics, parades, and concerts. Juneteenth is a celebration of Black culture and its contributions to the culture at large. But its significance is rooted in its history, according to event organizer Sam Collins. He says a 460-square-meter mural in downtown Galveston honors General Gordon Granger, his mostly Black troops, and the people who were freed.
There were only about 1,200, a little over 1,000 enslaved people on the island. But after Juneteenth, the message spread from the island, and those 1,200 people plus the other 250,000 enslaved people in the state of Texas kept the oral history of what happened here in Galveston alive.
Juneteenth has a deep emotional connection for many African Americans, but some white people support it as well, like Ronnie Hall from Baytown, Texas.
Well, I think it may have started out for just Black people, but I think it's gotten bigger than that.
So you You celebrated too yourself?
Yeah, sure.
There were more people of all races at the island's beaches on the weekend than at Juneteenth events, but some residents and visitors enjoyed a Juneteenth parade. U.S. Army veteran Tawan Parsons came here from Louisiana for Juneteenth.
Well, it's important to remember what has happened, but don't let ourselves be defined by the past. Utilize this time to not only celebrate the freedom that was achieved by the people here in Galveston, but to remind ourselves to look forward to our continued freedom.
Parsons worries about attempts by some politicians to hide aspects of history that they find disturbing, including slavery. Collins says knowledge of historic events like Juneteenth could reduce political polarization and help the country.
We're responsible for repairing the foundation of this country by telling the truth and telling the true history in those stories, because the only way we're going to heal is to tell the truth.
Collins says some people think educators promote guilt rather than patriotism with their emphasis on slavery. But he argues that a truthful depiction of history will make the country stronger. Greg Flakus for VOA News, Galveston, Texas.
Remix. That's all we prepared for you on this Juneteenth holiday. We now leave you with the song Balumba with Pepe and Philip featuring Eddie Kenzo. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. Don't forget to visit voafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss this program, go to www.voafrica.com/South Sudan. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Killer Williams, we wish you a good evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The population of sub-Saharan Africa is projected to double by 2050, according to the United Nations. That poses urgent challenges in terms of food security. In early May, the U.S. State Department's Office of the Special Envoy for Global Food Security organized a panel discussion during the AIM for Climate Summit to discuss the vision for adapted crops and soils, otherwise known as VACS. The initiative, launched in collaboration by the U.S. government, the African Union, and the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, focuses on the development of climate-resilient seeds and improvement of soil health to boost agricultural production. Today, agriculture faces an historically unprecedented combination of challenges, said U.S. Special Envoy for Global Food Security, Carrie Fowler. Building food security really depends on our addressing all of these challenges. The panelists were some of the foremost experts in numerous fields affecting agricultural production, including Professor Linda Way Majole Sabanda, Chair of CGIAR System Board, Commissioner Joseph Asako from the African Union Commission for Agriculture, Rural Development, Blue Economy, and Sustainable Environment, Dr. Cynthia Rosenzweig from AGMIP and the Columbia Climate School, Lisa Safarian, President and Chief Operating Officer with the agricultural technology company Pivot Bio, and Dr. Robert Reiter, Head of Research and Development in Crop Science at Bayer. Food security depends on addressing the fundamental aspects of having fertile soils and crops adapted to climate change, noted Dr. Fowler. Yet what we find all over the world, and certainly in Africa, are depleted soils. Our crops are not sufficiently prepared for climate change. Our institutions are not sufficiently prepared. We forged a partnership with the African Union and the Food and Agriculture Organization, but also with many others to try to address this particular issue, said Dr. Fowler. Pivot Bio is pursuing a fascinating approach to providing climate-neutral nitrogen to the roots of our crops. Bayer has a very serious analysis of what ails us and is engaged in a wide range of scientific and philanthropic activities. Cynthia Rosenzweig is working with us from NASA and from Columbia Climate School on new climate modeling so we can better understand how the important nutritious crops for Africa will fare in the current and future climates of Africa. At the most fundamental level, those challenges in food security really depend on our having fertile soils and depends on having adaptive crops adapted to climate change.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.